G'day everyone and welcome to this latest Soapbox special from Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This is not the weekly show. This is a deep dive vendor-oriented podcast. We do these 10 times a year. All of the vendors who appear in these Soapbox podcasts are paid to be here. But you know what? Even though this is sponsored content, it is really interesting. And I am as surprised as you are at how interesting these things have actually turned out. Believe me. And this Soapbox edition is a double surprise because we're talking about one of the driest topics in InfoSec, email filtering, and, drumroll please, it's actually a really engaging conversation. I was dead set shocked by how much I enjoyed talking to our guests in this special, Ryan Callumber and Christopher Izzoni of Proofpoint. Proofpoint, among other things, is a huge player in email security and filtering. They're having a great time now, actually, as people make the switch to Office 365 and decide against routing their mail hairpin style through their crappy little on-prem legacy solutions, their blinky light boxes. Proofpoint can do on-prem, but as you'll hear, the vast majority of what they're doing is cloud-based these days. And yeah, this conversation all hinges on a report Proofpoint published back in, I think I want to say August, around then. The copy I have isn't dated, but I think that's right. In it, they made some really important observations. Like, for example, the death of popular exploit kits like Angler has just pushed attackers into social engineering at scale as their primary attack vector. And, you know, that can be anything from straight-up fraud, attachment malware, macro stuff. And, you know, some of these campaigns involve really sophisticated mass personalization. The days of exploit kits being used at scale might actually be over. You know, Angler, Black Hole, they're all gone, as is a bunch of the client-side software that those sort of kits would attack, like Flash and Java. So it means it might not actually be feasible for people out there to rebuild an exploit kit ecosystem that's effective again. Drive-by downloads as a mass attack vector are almost certainly dead, and all the major crews have, as I mentioned, they have shifted to social engineering as a vector, and most of that is done via email. And, you know, I was a little bit skeptical at first, but you flip through this report and, yeah, it's certainly very convincing. That report is called The Human Factor, and I've linked through to it in the post for this podcast. You'll have to enter your email to get it, but whatever. So I picked it up and gave it a read before we recorded this session. And, yeah, I mean, it is a pretty typical 24-page vendor report. The key difference being the findings are genuinely interesting and the data is genuinely interesting. Proofpoint's SVP, Cybersecurity Strategy, Ryan Callumber, and their manager of threat research, Christopher Izzoni, joined me to discuss the Human Factor Report and also to talk about why email filtering is, you know, suddenly cool again. I do hope you enjoy this. Oh, and for those who are interested, I've actually included a bit of an anecdote at the end of the show about one case of message filtering gone wrong. It's just a funny story, yeah, you might enjoy it. Anyway, here are Ryan and Chris, and the first voice you'll hear is Ryan Callumber.
It's actually a report we've done for a couple of years now that was really driven by our fairly unique perspective on the threat landscape. I mean, we just see malware, credential phish, all of this stuff coming into organizations day after day after day after day, whereas, you know, the industry doesn't necessarily spend as much time as I think we ought to focusing on how targeted individuals are and actually a lot of the detail behind that targeting that I think can inform our work as defenders as well as just simply be interesting as we define our threat models and everything else that a modern security organization does.
Yeah, I want to get into this this concept of mass personalization because that seems to be an area where attackers have really lifted their game and recently, right? So the one thing that struck me about this report is the swings in numbers and percentages and stuff. You mentioned that you've done this report before. How did this report compare to last year's? Because I didn't see last year's, but it seems like I'm guessing the numbers are fairly different.
They really are. One of the more obvious ones was the shift in cred phish, right? So for most of 2016, of the malicious URLs out there, and we saw tens of billions of them, about 74% of them were pointing to credential phishing sites. So frankly, no malware at all. In 2016, that number was 90%. And actually, if you look at the last 12 months, the number is back down to about 60% as URLs have become a little bit more popular for the kind of scale ransomware actors and a few of the others at work there. But the mass personalization thing that I find really fascinating is it's sort of the after effect of all this credential phishing that's gone on. You know, we've even seen things like a fairly interesting recent EarthSniff campaign that was actually replying to legitimate email threads. So fully expected, and not the sort of thing that you can expect any human to identify. Real thread, real recipients, but they're replying with a piece of malware.
So we literally call that actor the personalized actor, and we've seen them operating in our data for quite some time. You know, some time ago, they were one of the first actors to start leveraging what appears to be stolen data to make highly, highly personal email templates, leveraging people's org structure, leveraging things like titles in the emails and the file names. That's kind of hard to get any other way.
So hang on. So they're actually taking email creds and just jumping into actual threads within organizations. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what we're saying. And they are real threads. It is. I'd also add, actually, that one of the things that we've seen them do is, you know, there's all kinds of Salesforce phishing and other things that were kind of odd targets. I mean, I guess they would be somewhat interesting to a financially motivated actor. But what we've really seen is that these cybercriminal organizations have developed a really thorough understanding of org structures at the organizations they're targeting. And that can be as simple as a one-time lure that is sent to you copying your manager and saying, I had a terrible experience with Patrick at your office. I've written it up in the attached document. Please get back to me as soon as you can.
Yeah, and you're thinking, God, we got a company lawsuit coming.
Exactly.
Now we're talking about how it's less about credential theft and more about trying to encourage users to install malware. How much of that is because ransomware has become such a big driver? Because I would have thought that would be a big part of this, but then I delve into your report and it looks like banking malware is still very, very hip. You know, banking credential theft in browser malware is still hip.
Yeah, it's a really good point, actually. So what I think has changed is those types of attacks that used to be limited to the Carbonac Fin7s of the world, they've now figured out how to basically scale them. And one of the things that would be different if that attack occurred today is that they probably wouldn't have even bothered with the vuln and the associated exploit. They would have just gotten their target to run the code for them. And that could take lots and lots of different forms, but we'll frequently be digging into customer data for a really highly targeted, maybe Fortune 100 organization. They probably saw 300,000-400,000 threats in a given week or so. Maybe 30 or 40 will actually be associated with a CVE. So that's actually a fairly fascinating part of the data here. And you're right that it has a little bit of a different application to ransomware versus bankers. But at their core, actually, bankers and ransomware are being delivered in effectively the same ways. They're all relying on users to run code, whether that's something as garbage as a VBA macro or it's, you know, package or shell object. You know, there's infinite permutations that they're constantly experimenting with. But it is pretty extraordinary to see on a relatively consistent basis that north of 99% of all the badness targeting people in these organizations requires the human to activate the malware.
I think something that is really relevant here and somewhat new is that the shift from bankers to ransomware, which we're now seeing reversed again, was really allowed a lot of new actors to get into the game. And a lot of these actors didn't really have the same sophistication as the folks who used to deliver, say, Drydex and Dyreza, right? You know, kind of anybody can go write a ransomware and deliver the stuff. And, you know, now the delivery techniques are so simple. It's like, it's fairly easier for these guys to scale up.
So that is interesting because, as I say, when I dove into the report and saw the percentage swings, I was thinking, okay, ransomware has got to be behind this, but it absolutely isn't. One, it seems like a whole bunch of things have actually come together here, and one of them seems to be, you know, a lot of these popular exploit kits and, you know, exploit rental services like Angler and whatever, a couple of things have happened there. First of all, some of the bigger kits, the people who maintained them got busted, and another thing is those kits got less effective because a lot of them were selling things like Java bugs. I mean, you take those two things together, even when you take those two things together, it doesn't fully explain this whole shift, does it? But it certainly, you would certainly think that was a contributor, the unavailability of exploit kits to the general crimeware market.
Yeah, I think it's a really big part of it. I mean, if you rewind the clock back to 2013, right, and this is actually about when I joined Proofpoint, you know, black hole was the single biggest threat on the internet, right? Depending on who you talk to, between 60 and 90%. Of malware delivered via the internet was coming in over black hole. That got shut down. We, in our data, definitely saw kind of the churn afterwards as they experimented with new techniques. We had a couple other kits that were previously pretty small fill in to take the place. But Angler was kind of the clear dominating force afterwards. But when Angler pretty much dropped off the face of the earth last year, nothing really jumped up to fill in their place.
Yeah, and that really surprised me, right? Because, you know, we've seen things get swatted down. It's whack-a-mole, right? We always used to think that was whack-a-mole. And I remember talking about that concept with a bunch of people I know who work in law enforcement, you know, mostly in the Australian Federal Police here, who handle the large-scale cybercrime stuff. And they said, look, you can actually disrupt criminal networks. This idea that you can't make a dint is kind of like popular wisdom that's not entirely correct. You can actually disrupt, particularly the organized crime, and it takes them a while to rebuild. Do you think we are going to see a rebuilding around those kits, or do you think this is more of a permanent shift to social engineering-based attacks, and that retooling and rebuilding exploit kits like this is just going to be too difficult?
Now, it's a really good point, and it's actually true across not just exploit kits, but even email malware. Right. So we saw a couple of arrests in late 2015 basically lead to 8 or 9 weeks of nothing from the biggest actors.
Yeah,
if you remember. They just went dead silent, laying low for a while, and then they came back with a campaign that we saw, I think, 40 million emails. It was some staggering number.
I know people who worked in ops who thought there was something wrong with their mail infrastructure, you know, because everything just got super quiet.
Exactly.
And you know, we see that. We have pretty good trend data on that stuff. You can see when they get scared. You know, you'll see a takedown, they get scared for 3 weeks, and then all of a sudden they sort of, a couple actors will trickle in, and then a couple more, and then you're back to normal.
Yeah, but we haven't seen that with exploit kits. And I guess the question is, do you think we will, or do you think that horse has bolted? And because there's, you know, no more Flash, no more Java, better controls, more people on Windows 10, do you think that maybe the days of the effective exploit kit are kind of over? Because I hope so.
I think you kind of nailed it in a sense. I mean, even these exploit kits, we're seeing shift towards inclusion of social engineering techniques using fake font file downloads instead of exploits to deliver malware.
Yeah, so, I mean, we saw Magnitude use a fake Windows Defender security update recently. So you're right. Those vulns are not available. And so drive-by downloads are simply not a major feature of the threat landscape right now. And I don't think they're coming back given what you pointed out around Windows 10, but also Edge, IE, Chrome, a little bit less on IE, but you know, progress has been made with the browser manufacturers. So right now, what the attackers want to do is escape the sandbox by socially engineering a human into downloading something that they can then execute.
Well, and it's also the reason why we're seeing, and this is a growing thing, is we're seeing people buy disused plugins, or you know, sort of abandoned plugins for Chrome and stuff, and then you know, purchasing them from the original developer and then loading them up with malware, right? So we're seeing this whole shift to the supply chain attack. And just, you know, with CCleaner, some people call it CC Cleaner. I just call it CCleaner because I don't imagine that third C. But, you know, we saw CCleaner getting hosed, and that's being some, you know, huge targeted attack. I mean, this thing that you told me about, you know, legitimate accounts jumping into legitimate corporate company mail threads and dropping malware that way. I mean, that's extraordinary. Something that's similar that I didn't realize was actually a trend and was a serious thing is this idea of people replying to support requests on platforms like Twitter. So you might write, hey, AT&T, you know, what's the go? I can't log in, or something like that. You see those sort of messages. People are actually keeping an eye out for keywords on multiple companies, and they've got dummy support accounts that look legitimate, and then they're replying with dodgy links for things like credential harvesting, you know, malware downloads, you need to download this tool to run it, whatever. Is this an edge case, or is this something that's really growing, this sort of social media support request hijacking?
It's really growing when it comes to financial services. Right, what we're seeing is fairly endemic is that, you know, attackers now know at what time the customer service department goes offline. Right? And so as soon as you tweet at that customer service department, you'll get a reply back, because anyone can see your ats, right, on Twitter, from something that looks highly legitimate. They've taken to even taking things like the blue check mark and putting it in the header image.
Yeah, so of course,
They're clever in certain ways, but they'll simply point you to a phishing link, and you know, you can see people respond to these phishers because obviously all of that is being done in public. Although they're trying to point you to a Credfish site most of the time, it's this typical game of whack-a-mole. If you're not looking for versions of accounts out there on Twitter and lots of other social media that's now used for customer service for millennials and everybody else who actually wants that. It's becoming the sort of thing that FinServe in particular is seeing a lot of. I wouldn't be surprised, though, if it spread to other high-value targets like mobile phone providers, as you pointed out, because that's the gateway to so much other interesting information and password account resets, et cetera.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're actually starting to see, like we've been saying, I think I remember the first time that I heard someone say SMS two-factor was a terrible idea was when I was working for ZDNet in Sydney, which puts that around 2003. And I, at that time, I thought, okay, that's a bit stupid, right? Because it clearly was better than what was available at the time, right? And it did serve us very well. And I think the death knell really for SMS two-factor was this recent attack against some of these Bitcoin exchanges where they actually did the attacks at scale using SS7, right? Which is like, okay, now we know that's not effective. But this brings up another topic that you cover quite extensively in the report, which is this idea of automation. And attackers have really got their shit together when it comes to automation now to an extent that I didn't quite realize. Why don't you talk about this concept of mass personalization? Because it's not just about putting someone's name in an email or something. I mean, they're doing automated context for these attacks, and it's turning out to be quite effective. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, I would say the automation happens at a few different levels, right? Especially with these heavily customized actors. You know, we see it in the body of the email. We see it in the file name. We see it evidenced in kind of where the messages are coming from. But it's happening at other levels of the attack chain as well, right? I think one of the bigger components of automation that was impactful in the industry was as they got really good at re-crypting that first stage on these macro downloaders, right? So regenerating that macro every few messages. So in these campaigns, they used to appear to have, say, you know what, 4 or 5 hashes on a big day. Suddenly they have 50,000 hashes, you know, and that kind of left everybody in the dust as they figured out how to sort of scale up those operations.
Yeah, so they managed to, as Chris was saying, both inject personalization into the actual crypting of the files as well as the lures that were going into the emails. And, you know, that's led to, frankly, a really interesting set of things failing, right? Gateway antivirus, for example, became utterly useless from an email perspective. And given that that's where, you know, at least the preponderance of malware for most organizations comes in the door, it really led to a bad time for a lot of people. And that was exacerbated by the shift from bankers, who would only really affect somebody who had creds to, you know, the web banking that the organization was using, to things like ransomware. And we're kind of reenacting what happened in 2015. But, you know, the trend has done nothing but really intensify, because they've gotten personalization and automation to work across not only their sending infrastructure, which they had nailed for a few years now, but for the first stage payloads and the second stage payloads and a lot of the other parts of the attack chain.
Look, and I think that's one of the reasons why email gateway scanners have kind of been, like, that's where the criticisms have come from, because it's like, well, if you just automated this and this, you'd probably slip right through them, and now that's exactly what we're seeing. But we're gonna talk about some responses to this and what you actually can do with email gateway, because obviously that is your business. But one thing I'm curious about is, when it comes to threat intelligence, right, we're looking at so many crews who are looking to perform intrusions and whatever, but I'm guessing the number of people who have substantial access to spam botnets, like the real big ones, a lot of the spam botnets, the ownership is quite concentrated, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. How many crews are out there that are pushing, you know, 80%? Because I'm guessing there's like 3 or 4 crews pushing 80% of the spam. Is that right? Or am I off base there?
Yeah, that sounds pretty accurate. You know, I mean, you look at how much of this is accounted for just by the Necker's botnet at this point. It's a significant amount of spam. I don't know exactly how many. Now I want to go visit one of our spam guys and find out.
Yeah, as Chris was mentioning, it really is down to that one botnet, which is responsible for a huge percentage of things. And when they launch things like Locky campaigns, there's not even that many affiliate IDs that, you know, we can look at the malware, scrape the config, and figure out who's getting paid on each infection, right? And the affiliates, there's only a few of those even.
Yeah, there's really just a handful of actors that account for 90% of the threat volume we see on a daily basis. Everything else is long tail. And yeah, it's big Locky actors who were also responsible for, you know, involved with Drydex, right? And then you know, and then some sort of smaller regionally kind of targeted stuff, these sort of Eurosniff campaigns or the Retefe campaigns that account for the rest of it.
Now, look, we were just talking about some social media based stuff, and that is obviously the way to address that is to actually have a response team that is looking at Twitter and looking at all of these sort of legitimate channels, right? So that's the solution to that. But most of what we're talking about is concerned with threats that come in via email, right? And this is not a new problem, letting stuff into your organization that you don't want in there. But I'm wondering, because I'm frankly not really in tune with what the latest approaches are to stopping this. And it is your business. So why don't you walk me through it? Because my solution is I use Gmail, right? And Gmail, because they're handling so much stuff in aggregate, they do a pretty good job of stripping out badness. The occasional thing gets through, there's the occasional false positive, but by and large, I'm pretty happy. But what does a specialist provider like Proofpoint actually do about this sort of stuff? What is their general approach?
Well, it's a really interesting question because it's changed quite a lot in the last couple of years. You know, as people have realized that, you know, it depends whether you want to use the Verizon stats or, you know, Kevin Mandia testifying in front of Congress said 95% of what Mandia investigates starts with an email. You know, people started paying a whole lot of attention to what you were catching on that vector, even using techniques that were not designed to catch malware. All right, so going back 4 or 5 years, the same sort of machine learning that actually in the InfoSec world, for those of us who go back a while, you know, Markov chains were used in spam detection before they were used in any kind of fancy machine learning on the endpoint or anywhere else. Mm. Right, that was actually reasonably useful in catching these big, broad campaigns, much more so than Gateway Antivirus when they got really good at recrypting everything and everything was coming across with a unique hash. So even if you pushed def updates in 5 minutes, it didn't matter because the whole campaign was sent in 4 minutes. Right, so actually, that occasioned people taking a whole new look at that threat vector because it was such a no-brainer for attackers to use it for, frankly, any purpose, whether it was the credential phishing side, which is actually almost an entirely separate problem, and then the malware side of things. But now a modern email security provider does full kill chain analysis on everything before it ever gets delivered to an end user. So
all of those links have been crawled and explored by the time it hits someone's inbox sort of thing.
Absolutely. Oh, and the files as well.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, two things really define it, right? One, a layered approach, and then two, taking a really flexible approach to this. I mean, if anything has become true, it's that these guys, I mean, the attackers are able to adapt every day. You know, if they see us driving good efficacy on something, they might try another vector. And so really, I think in short, it's, as Ryan said, taking first a reputation-based approach to it, right? So your traditional machine learning techniques, we have new models now that can take a lot more features into account. But then for things that would traditionally pass through that reputation-based model, we are doing the full kill chain analysis, right? So detonating them not just in one sandbox, but a variety of sandboxes on a variety of platforms from a number of different geographies. And then for dual purposes, right? One, to detect things and knock them down, but on the other hand, also to get as much data about their infrastructure as possible. And so sandboxing for longer periods of time to boost our own intel efforts, and then also to really help inform our customers about who these folks are.
I'm just thinking back to my days as an engineering student in Melbourne. And one of the things that we did as an exercise was we learned how to calculate the total amount of information in a certain message by hand, right? You do your sort of entropy curve and you can come up with like an information content score for a given piece of data. And I'm thinking if you actually sat down and worked out how much real information is in an email, it's very small, right? And I'm wondering if that's part of the challenge here is because, you know, it's such a tiny piece of information when you're dealing with, you know, something that is in essence a text protocol. And it's just a chunk of text that's supposed to be human readable in a language like English. How do you start? I mean, it's just a hard problem, isn't it? Is that one of the factors that makes it difficult is that you're just working with such tiny fragments of information?
Yeah, when there's not a file or a URL to sandbox, that's absolutely true. And actually where that most manifests itself is in a problem that not all InfoSec people think is their job, but basically fraudulent email, right? If spoofed email has become such a massive problem because humans are really prone to falling for it, right? Whether it's the ridiculous W-2 scams or impersonating a CEO or trying to change payment instructions for a legitimate invoice, Yeah, that's the sort of thing where you do have exactly that problem. There's not a lot to analyze. There's no malware. There are no links that we can look for in terms of, you know, does this land on a Credfish page? So there you do have to actually look at everything that's in the header, everything that's in the envelope, the subject line. You have to kind of take content snippets and find new features to analyze.
Every IP or host name that shows up in headers needs to get a solid workout, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've taken it a step beyond that, though, too. You know, taking the body content and breaking it into shingles and analyzing those in different combinations.
And there's one really good example, which is, so say you have a malicious invoice lure, right, which is, or a package notification, one of those really, really common ones. Even if I know nothing about the sending infrastructure and maybe my sandbox failed to detect that the attachment was malicious, if I know that the same invoice was sent to 5,000 of my customers, there's no way that's legitimate. They didn't all forget to pay it at the same time. So even use the reputation of that and then take that to ding the reputation of every single IP in that header and really take a composite view of it. You can take what is a very limited amount of information and build it into a really interesting and powerful model.
It's funny, right? Because, you know, I mentioned earlier that I use Google, right, for this. And it's funny seeing where it fails, particularly when it comes to false positives, because they're flagging stuff with, you know, people sending me email from the same SMTP box that they always send me email from, right? They haven't changed anything, and occasionally it gets flagged as spam. And I would have thought a 10-year history of talking to that person would maybe put them on some sort of whitelist. But I think this just proves how difficult it is. I mean, I know I'm just using a consumer-grade service. But I'm curious, too. Like, most companies these days tend to offer, you know, SMTP filtering as some sort of cloud-based service as opposed to gateways that sit at your within your enterprise data center. Is that what you are doing? Or are you offering actual, you know, here's a box or here's a VM, install it at your on your mail infrastructure?
Yeah, nearly all of what we deploy these days is cloud. Most of it sits in front of some form of hybrid Office 365, maybe G Suite, maybe Exchange Server. And that move to the cloud has actually occasioned people to take a new look at what these controls were. Because if you think about it, if you move to Office 365, there are your Exchange Servers out there. Your threats are now out there because they're mostly coming through via email. And then OneDrive and SharePoint and all your data is out there as well. So it's been a good occasion to get people to take another look at their security controls regarding that. But most of what we deploy outside of very specific geographies where they have other reasons to deploy on-prem would be cloud.
Yeah, I'm guessing there'll be some really funny regulations from that were written in like 2001 that would cause people to have to go on-prem. One thing I am, or, you know, certain types of organizations that, you know, have to do that.
Yes.
I'm guessing one thing, though, that is very useful about this cloud approach and, you know, all customers, even customers using edge, you know, equipment are going to benefit from is this idea that all of a sudden you're able to get an awful lot of information flowing through systems you control. And that can be very handy because the best way to fight spam seems to be in an aggregate when you're dealing with the larger campaigns, right?
Yeah, certainly for the large campaigns. For more targeted things, we have to do other things which are also enabled by cloud, right? So now that we can do a cloud sandbox, right? One of the things that Chris was pointing out is that the attackers change every day. So the sandbox has to change every day, maybe multiple times per day to account for the evolution of their own techniques. And the other things that we can do is really kind of mimic the defense in depth that you would classically have in a great information security operation, but do it all before something gets delivered, right? So if we're detonating a file in a sandbox, we can run a world-class Suricata IDS rule set around that. So that same network hit that would have happened had somebody clicked on the bad link on their work PC behind the corporate firewall, assuming that happens like 10% of the time these days, you know, we'd get that same IDS hit before we ever delivered anything. And we would never be able to do anything like that were we on-prem. It just simply has to be done in the cloud.
Yeah, and I would say as a researcher, right, I was a security researcher for 15 years, it's kind of turned us all from these sort of backroom malware geeks and IDS geeks into data scientists, right?
Like, well, this is actually where I was going with this, right, is because now, you know, in aggregate, you can very easily spot the large campaigns, right? I mean, even someone running a large enterprise mail gateway for a single company is going to have enough data. They're going to be getting enough spam to be able to be more or less effective against the big campaigns. Where it gets interesting is when you start dealing with the targeted stuff, right? Your DNC phishing emails and things like that. So what I'm imagining the game is largely about for Proofpoint is actually just going hunting in this massive data set and looking for ways to identify the smaller campaigns. Is that right?
Yeah, you've pretty much nailed it. It's so what we've done is we've created this process around identifying the day's large campaigns. Analysts write them up so they're grouped in the dashboard, and then the rest of the time is spent hunting for the cool targeted stuff, right? Okay, well, what's Carbonac up to today? What are we seeing APT28 up to today? And who are they targeting and why? You know, is something we can answer because of the email.
Now, how much of that is manual and how much of this is creating some new revision of a machine learning algorithm and sort of unleashing it on a sample data set? Because I'd imagine you can't store all of the email that you process, right? So you're going to need to work off a sample. Is that right? Or do you capture the lot?
Exactly. So it's kind of a hybrid approach, right? I think machine learning is most powerful when you use it to generate reports that skilled analysts can then go look at to find something interesting and create a compelling narrative. And
so that's, you want to create like a little ML shark, that an ML Pac-Man that goes around just gobbling through that data, right? And then returns something that you might want to look at later.
Exactly. And so we've created a model where our analysts can go write microservices that can hook into different parts of the data and find cool things, surface them, and analysts can do what they will with them.
Yeah, and I'd actually add to that the data itself and how you handle that has a big impact on it. So a few years ago, we decided to build the largest graph database that I think any of us had ever seen. We built it with technology we probably wouldn't use today were we to start over, but it's grown to 500 billion nodes in size.
It just depends.
And you can think it just depends on the day. But we want to keep as much of that data as possible, especially the data that is sort of do not erase, this is bad guy data, and navigate through that with sort of a Multigo on steroids approach. And that's also quite useful.
Yeah, what's become really important to us isn't identifying one individual threat. It's the relationship between that threat and other things in our data, right? And so, as we move forward, we plug new types of data sources into this. So now I can take a threat seen in email and go hunting for, related threats in social or mobile, sharing infrastructure. And then you get some really interesting stories.
So I want to ask you a question about measurability, right? Because what you're telling me is that you've been able to, you're clearly people who know an awful lot about email security, and you're doing your best to try to apply this at scale. But the hard part of what you're trying to do is you're not just trying to knock out the big campaigns, you're trying to knock out the targeted stuff as well. Have you been able to measure the impact or the outcomes that you've been able to deliver to clients when they've actually switched to your service? Is that something you can measure, or is it just too difficult?
That's absolutely something you can measure. One of the great things about our customers is that, we work with over 50 of the Fortune 100. They're very, very good at finding things if we miss them, and they're even better at telling us about that. So it actually is not only very, very easy from an email gateway perspective, because you're another hop, right? You can sit behind what other incumbent solution is there and have genuine data in terms of the things that you caught that the other solution missed.
Well, if it slips through the gateway, the EDR might catch it, or, something might get it. Yeah.
Exactly. And they'll let us know, right? So one of the things we've been very successful at is actually reporting out on these FNs. So if we get an FN report, not only can we see, all right, was this something we could correlate back into a campaign, whether it's a targeted campaign or a really broad-based campaign, but then we also look for it in the last 15 days of our data to see if we've delivered it anywhere, and then we can actually alert on that. So even if we find something in a very unorthodox way or we get it from a customer report, we can absolutely quantify what we miss. And the nice thing about that is most of the time we're very, very, very effective, and even being upfront about our false negatives, when we see 99% of the organization's malware before it ever hits those endpoints, we have great data.
It gives their EDR less to do, right?
It gives their EDR, it takes the burden off, exactly.
And I think more and more of our customers are exploring things like automation, right? It's like they're having a hard time finding security expertise, so they're building more automation to sort of fill that role. And so if we can, A, report on the things that we missed, and then B, give them enough information about those things that they can go. They hunt for things that came in via the side door.
The one macro point that we're always making with the human factor report and elsewhere is that you know, if you do a good job at making sure fewer threats get through to humans, who we know we cannot teach to not click on things, right? I think almost all of us who have been in InfoSec for longer than 10 minutes know that, then you're simply taking the pressure off in all kinds of other ways. And that's true on the malware side. It's also true on the CredFish side, which is illustrated nicely by all of these attacks that only exist because the credentials have been stolen. And I think I actually go back to a point Rich Mogul made on your show quite a while back when he was talking about the big disruption happening in the industry, right? When your back office goes to SaaS, when your data center goes to infrastructure as a service, and when you don't control all your endpoints anymore, what are the attackers going to do? They're going to keep phishing us. They're going to keep sending over channels that we use to do our work. And I think technologies that protect users against those things are going to continue to play a big role and take the pressure off other traditional forms of security controls.
I'm so glad you cited that that interview, because it was one of my favorites for years,
yeah.
Right? Because like Rich is a deeply, deeply insightful guy. He used to work at Gartner. Don't hold that against him. But he's an incredibly intelligent guy. And everything that he said in that interview, I was just like, yeah, this is the cloud fireball coming to destroy the RSA trade floor in the next 5 to 10 years. Like that is absolutely happening.
Can't happen soon enough.
It can't happen soon enough, indeed. Do you come up against, I'm imagining your competitors of people like, you know, Message Labs, which is now part of Symantec, stuff like that. Is that where you see your competition?
Yeah, those are the classic ones. But, you know, we've actually managed to grow into being the sixth largest cybersecurity company that's publicly traded by market capitalization by sweeping up kind of the old vendors, the Message Labs, the Iron Ports of the world. But really what it is now is people are moving to Office 365 and they're looking at that blinky box in the corner and wondering whether it makes sense to hairpin their email traffic through it. And usually the answer is no. And they probably also think they could do a little bit better in terms of taking the pressure off from both a CredFish and malware perspective if they had a better solution. So it's been good from a structural perspective, because I think apart from us, there haven't been a lot of people focused on really innovating on the gateway side of things.
Who would have thought that mail filtering would be cool again? And further, who would have thought that two people from a mail filtering company would actually be able to convince me that mail filtering is cool again? Well, Ryan Kalamba and Christopher Izzoni, thank you very much for coming onto the show and doing one of these soapboxes and talking us through all of this mail threat stuff, which, as I just said, I found it, if I'm going to be completely honest, I found this a lot more interesting than I was expecting to. So thanks a lot.
Thanks, Patrick. It was a pleasure.
Hey, thanks, Patrick.
That was Ryan Kalamba and Christopher Izzoni of Proofpoint there. You can find them at proofpoint.com. I've linked through to the Human Factor Report in the post for this podcast, so you can just go punch in your email address and get your very own copy, if that is something you want to do. Now, before we go, I do want to tell a funny story about when cloud email filtering goes wrong. The vendor in this case was Message Labs. Now, a buddy I know, let's call him John. John was a Message Labs customer, and he's just, rocked up to work one day. And all of a sudden, inbound mail just stopped. And after a few minutes of panic, he figured out that Message Labs had pulled the plug on their service. Now, John is a very, very good friend of mine, and in a panic, he rang me to see if I knew anyone at Message Labs, because he couldn't get through to anyone. And, I managed to connect him with someone, and eventually, after a substantial outage, they turned the service back on. So Message Labs had actually pulled the pin over non-payment of an invoice. So this is the thing. John had received the invoice, but he was in the middle of negotiating with the company over a migration, and he hadn't paid it yet because they were going to do some package deal or something, whatever. It's just run-of-the-mill vendor negotiations. But yeah, he had not paid the invoice. But here is the punchline. Message Labs accounts had actually sent him a payment demand and threatened to disconnect his service. Now, this is the punchline. This is the real punchline. This is the reason that I'm telling this story, and I think you can see where this is going. John never saw the demand letter because Message Labs had filtered it. They blocked their own threat to terminate services. That is a true story. Blocking their own correspondence and pulling the pin on a fairly substantial company. Now, look, that was a few years back. I'm sure they've learned from their mistakes. But, just thinking about that gets me every time. But yes, that is it for this edition of the Soapbox Podcast and Story Corner with Pat. But I'll be back next week with another weekly show. Until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.